second full day of the HBPA convention, and they'll conclude tomorrow. Oh, and he's like a Jack in the Box, Eric Hamelbeck. The minute I say HBPA convention, Eric is here. We're going to talk to Eric and get the message delivery for the convention, and a couple of Q&A. We started yesterday, of course, with Dr. Daniels, the newish president and chairman. We've got a full morning, and there might be some pickup conversations in addition to what we've got scheduled. Hammer is here. I'll say good morning, Hammer.
Good morning. And sounds like we got a little bit more pep in our voice today. We had our panel discussion. We got done yesterday. I know we were thinking about that during the show yesterday, but that was done. I think that was a success, inspiring people in the industry to do their part and getting the word across and reaching out to our fan base and our horse players and teach them whatever they want to know and get them more involved. And that was Eric's idea to do that, and I think it was very energetic, and I think it came across well. Good morning, guys.
And we'll say I'm surprised that you want to use this with that head of hair you got going, Hamelbeck. I'm shocked that you want to put the headset on because you don't want to mess that hair up.
I don't want to mess my hair up. My wife will tell you I'm pretty particular. So.
Well, you got a full head. Me, Hammer, and I are not are in different stages of you know.
Yeah, I'm good.
The as Hammer mentioned yesterday's panel discussion, which essentially was framed for me because Eric approached me after listening to Ron Moquette and I in December. It was such a great conversation because Ron is so insightful, and the idea of how to be a good steward in the game from each perspective. And we had I want to thank Danny Caldwell for coming in from Oklahoma, and of course Ron who came in from the backside, and Hammer as well. So it was a real pleasure, and it was a little different, Eric, I think, than most of the more detailed and the more subject specific. We kind of just talked about the ambient circumstances around the game and how from each of those perspectives we can affect a positive influence.
Absolutely, Steve. And again, thank you for being here, Rick. Everyone at Oaklawn's been amazing. It's been an absolutely gorgeous facility to be in. We're very happy we were able to secure this. And special thanks to Judge Walmsley and the Arkansas HBPA for getting us in this spot. So, but yeah, the panel that you guys did yesterday, I think I even may have thrown a few people off representing the industry, just trying to save typing space. Ultimately, that idea started in 2018. We were in New Orleans for our conference, and I did a panel, and Jenny Reese was actually on it, and Tom Lamara came down. Actually, Michael Baychok was on the panel as well, and my goal was to get people to understand that if there's going to be good news about the industry spread, it needs to be by the people who are in the industry, because we could kind of see how things were going. Obviously, this may have been just sheer luck or a little bit of fortuitous gazing into the future. That was well before some of the tragedies that we've been through in the chaotic times, but it was a panel that really set forth that mentality. And the person that I wanted to mention most in that panel, who you might call a little bit of an outsider, but as an owner, was Greg Bensel. So Greg, I've gotten to know Greg actually when I was at Adena, but he's the senior VP of communications and marketing for the Saints and the Pelicans. He's worked for the Bensons for years. And he and I had a discussion when I was setting this panel up, and that was a piece of information that I really took from him. And it's, and you know, stealing Steve's word, we have to be our own stewards. We have to make sure that the message is proper. And so I've carried that, and it was really, you know, lit a fire under me when I heard Ron, and I said, I need to get that back again. So I think the four of you guys did a bang-up job. And while it was a little bit different tone than some of the other things, obviously when you listen to Mr. Lucas and you listen to his message and, you know, his words, you have to make a difference. You have to get out. You have to spread the word. And for me, it was a great tie-in, just luck or, you know, that's the way our industry goes. It's just it happens when it happens, and I think it was a good lead in to you guys, and it's a great message. And so I appreciate you guys for doing that.
It's our pleasure. And Eric, a few things in this opportunity to talk, and you know, we got kind of the overview and the perspective from Dr. Daniels yesterday with his new role and taking over for Leroy, and we're actually going to talk to Leroy later, and Bob Hutton from Arizona. Another jack in the box. I mentioned his name, and there he is. Bob Hutton, who was back home in Arizona. We're going to talk about this Arizona situation, which is not good and is a real problem. But Dr. Daniels providing the perspective, you know, as a veterinarian, not a racetrack practitioner, but a practice that is equine specific.
Right.
From the administrative side of things, provide everyone with an update. You did have a HISA session that I understand was, you know, we were on the air, but I understand it was really well received and informative. And yeah, Ed Martin sat with us yesterday, and Ed was really strong.
Very vocal, yes.
Very good yesterday, and remains prepared as part of RCI to interact with HISA if that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But where do things stand, Eric, legally and with the lawsuit and the states that have, since we last spoke, two more states have written amicus briefs?
Right. So, the filing challenging the constitutionality of HISA, the first filing was ours, along with 12 affiliates, you know, has now been joined in by the state of Texas and the Texas Horse Racing Commission. We have been through the hearing. The hearing was February 16th, and it was as fair of a hearing as you can possibly imagine. I was fortunate enough to be down there as an observer, and both sides presented their cases. The judge was extremely informed. And at this point, we do expect within a week or so, maybe, I don't know if it would be this week, but certainly next week, we expect some sort of ruling from Judge Hendricks. So the other case that I'm not as up on, but the second case that was filed in Kentucky, originally by West Virginia, Oklahoma, several entities, including Treo, the Thoroughbred Racing Association of Oklahoma and the Oklahoma Racing Commission, you know, was joined by Louisiana and then six other states. That case has not yet had a hearing, and I don't even know at this point if they've had a hearing date set. So that's really where we are with that. Where we go from here, I think obviously, and I will have my executive committee meeting today, but I don't think there's any question that whichever way the judge rules, there will be an appeal for our case to go to the Fifth Circuit, and we'll see at that point where we go from there. So, you know, that's where it stands on that side. But I also want to continue to say, you know, and I voiced a little bit of this with you, Steve, in December. Again, I hope that, you know, your listeners still take away the message that we are not here to be an obstructionist as we continue to be labeled. I want to make sure, as I said yesterday during just before the HISA panel, I do believe strongly myself that we need to define the constitutionality. Is it legal or not? One of the issues that's come up with the USADA group stepping back from the table, I know a lot of people still say that they're no longer there. I tend to not believe that they're completely gone. In that, I just mean, not trying to be cryptic, I still think there's room for them to be brought back in if they wish to do so. But when that announcement was made, I took it upon myself with Dr. Daniels and the legal team, essentially, that's been helping us with this group, this lawsuit, to make a suggestion within my statement about USADA backing away, in that I think now, if you look at the ARCI, they meet the qualifications of an enforcement agency. Again, there's interpretations, and people are going to interpret one way or the other the wording in the act, but I know that Ed Martin agrees with me. I took it upon myself to say in my statement, now would be the time for the current HISA board to look to the ARCI and develop and codify the model rules, employ them or contract them as the enforcement agency, and also joining with the safety regulations that have already been submitted to the FTC. Because I don't think I don't think that there's many people, including myself, that are going to say overly negative things about the safety aspect. For goodness sakes, I mean, we even made the comment in D.C. before that the old bill didn't go far enough, because again, we always maintained, and we still do, that if we're trying to eradicate or certainly lower the number of breakdowns, one thing we can say for sure, it's not been because of medication or abusive medication practices. It's about safety. It's about tracks. It's about constant evaluation. And so the safety aspects are important, and I think that short of some of the positions that have been created in the new safety regulations, there's not going to be many that argue that those are positive. And again, when you look at them from this aspect of the NTRA Safety Alliance, you know, those code of standards are essentially what the HISA regulations are. So, in other words, we're very supportive of those. And if they took the time, if the Mr. Sheeler and the board would consider sitting down with Ed Martin and his executive board and looking at having them become this enforcement agency, I think there's definitely room to be positive for the industry, because there's many of us who have campaigned, the compact. You'll hear a lot of people talk about the compact. And there were some states that didn't want to do it back then. But it's a different time now, right? With the help of the USTA and NARV, the North American Association of Racetrack Veterinarians, the three of us essentially put together a piece of legislation that I still have sitting on my desk that essentially codifies the model rules. It sets up a scientific arm that essentially would be coincide with the RMTC, but it also separates the breeds, which everybody wants to do. We were just never able to get that to the table with the momentum that the HISA legislation had. So, again, I was accused the other day of not ever bringing solutions to the table in a podcast. And, you know, people who say that just haven't been listening. I ask a lot of questions. One of the questions has been the why we need this bill. If it's just from an abusive medication standpoint, I don't see that. The stats don't back that up. There was a comment that Dr. Malin made, or I should say that someone quoted Dr. Malin, oh, there's 85 EPOs out there, and we only can test for 6 of them. Well, nobody thought to ask him, well, how many do they test in humans? Same 6. So where do we need to bring the funding? We need to bring the funding to the research to find the test. It's not that we're just not testing for them. The testing's not available, or it's not the right protocol. So I think whether it's baptism by fire or just circumstance, most people aren't in it in the depth of the weeds that I've become in. And so it's tough to kind of, you know, revisit or reply with a question on some of these circumstances. And I think the answers are there, but we just need to be, you know, asking the right questions.
You know, a couple of things that you said that kind of coincide or intersect with some things that Ed had to say yesterday, and that actually, Rick, that you've brought up as well. Rick had the occasion to has had a, between Arizona and this week the opportunity to spend time with Tom Rooney at NTRA. A lot of this begs the question, why has there not, and Alan Foreman brought this up as well, at Arizona, and you did as well in that brief visit we were able to have, because I know you didn't want to say, you know, too much until right. The dust had settled on USADA's exodus. What I'm angling toward is, why has there not been a summit, essentially? It would be a summit meeting would be ideal, where NTRA, Jockey Club, Sheeler and Lazarus, TRA or THA and HBPA, you know, essentially RCI, a summit meeting to put everybody in the same room and gain some consensus that does not feel like it's so far-fetched, right, when everybody has I would say 80% intersection and agreement. Tying up the 20% loose ends does not seem out of reach if everybody would sit down together.
I agree. I would only say now that because of the litigation, that's not going to happen at this point.
Even before the litigation, as Ed said, there was never any attempt to even reach out and
correct
interact with you know, stakeholders that correct. Were just involved.
That's correct.
Intrinsically,
that's correct. I mean, most certainly, I would get the invitation to mark up or give them a red line or do something with the bill. And again, as I said, I ask questions. You know, I'm not necessarily going to redline their bill. But that was the extent of it, you know. And ultimately, you know, my redlining first consisted of, please show us the proof of banning Lasix. Where does that fit in? You know, so it never went anywhere. But, and I said this yesterday at the HISA panel, to Ed's credit, and I may be off 1 year, but I believe it was 2017 at the ARCI meeting, the model rules meeting. He had a closed meeting with every...
After the end of the symposium.
Correct.
Thursday meeting.
Everyone was in the room at that point. So that was as close to at least my definition, your definition of a summit. I mean, every breed was represented. The AQHA was... the AAEP... yes, and the AQHA was there. We were all in a big room there, and Mark Lambert, the commissioner here, was currently the chairman. And you know, very open dialogue. You know, no media in the room, and ultimately a discussion about moving forth. There was only one entity, who didn't send their quote-unquote president and or CEO, but the one staff member that was there didn't want anything but the federal legislation. So I still always point back to that when people say, oh, you need to get everybody in a room. I would challenge them to say that, yes, we did at one point. And again, my ending statement yesterday was, when did the majority no longer rule and have the influence to change? So the majority didn't. It's right now it's just come down to money and power. But with all of that, I do still think that, as Rick said very well yesterday, there's going to have to be a point where we are all in a room together and can be able to talk open and freely. But you know, as we've seen time and time again getting to this point, there's been no communication from the HISA group. I mean, for goodness sakes, you got Pat Cummings writing about non-transparency, and I'm not going to say Pat's on our side or their side, but, you know, it's not just us that are very concerned about that issue. So whether they invite, whether Tom, they've not reached out to us either. So the NTRA has not reached out to us. I was on the Safety Alliance Committee, and I guess that's been dissolved. I've never been invited back. So again, there's that separation that continues to occur, unfortunately. But we'll see. We'll see once the litigation plays out.
Going to let you go because I know you got to get ready for the day's activities. But from another standpoint, a quick overview, a lot of progress in several areas, including a loosening of the restrictions on H-2B visas that is helping. What are you hearing back from affiliates in regards to personnel and staffing on the backstretch?
It's still, as much progress as we've made, I think there's still dire straits, certain pockets in particular. But with the Representative Cuellar and the bill that he's introduced, and now we've been working very hard on the Senate side to gain momentum, we're very close to getting the H-2B. He defines it as the Returning Worker Exception Act. We used to call it the Returning Worker Exemption. But that's a real possibility. But we've also, on a separate front, been working very closely with Senator Graham's office. He's put together what's called the definitions bill. And one of the things that's always excluded the horse racing industry from H-2A has been the lack of definition of equine laborer within the Immigration and Nationality Act. So we now have a definition. It's just a possible, you know, next step to get it put in. And so we're very excited about those two fronts, and Will Vile will be here. We're very honored to have the Assistant Secretary of the United States of Department of Agriculture, Oscar Gonzalez,
who's also
a commissioner for the CHRB, is going to be here on Friday. So we're very, very happy about the progress, but it's still a concern. It's still a concern.
What other topics have bubbled to the surface?
Well, I think one that's really, exploded to some people, and I was really happy to see that you had Richard and Michelle on yesterday. You know, fixed odds, Michelle and I kind of laughed. I think my first panel on fixed odds was 2016 when we went to British Columbia, of all places. We started talking about fixed odds and the concern and the need to be prepared, at least from the standpoint of revenue sharing for horsemen and how that's going to play out. You know, at the time we were also talking about exchange wagering, and as brilliant as Michelle is, she's continued to help me, guide me along with Dick Powell, trying to make sure that we educate our groups on how to be covered as this is coming through. Because I personally, I won't say it's a HBPA statement, but I think most of us agree, you know, any increase in quote-unquote fan base that can bring people to the table as a horse player, and if they're younger and they like fixed odds, let's bring it. You know, why would we not want to? But as we said with exchange wagering, devil's in the details to some degree, just to make sure that the horsemen, the owners in particular, are protected from the purse accounts. We do want to make sure that that doesn't get cannibalized. So, everything else has been great. The Horseman's Bookkeeper, a great educational panel. I have to thank Lauren Monet in our office who really brought that to the table and really took the ball and ran with it, and that's going to end up developing into a series within our benefits providers. So very happy about that.
Eric Hamelbeck, always a pleasure. We are looking forward to another day of presentations. Of course, D. Wayne yesterday.
Yeah.
And you've got tomorrow. We've got we've got Lou Sella.
Yep, Mr. Sella is going to come speak with us, and very honored that you know, he's able with the timing, but you know, they've been so generous to us, and they're treating us you know, to the carousel room tomorrow afternoon. And
nice.
So no, we're very, very happy to be here, and I think most people who know me personally, you know, I grew up between Louisiana Downs and this track and New Orleans, and working as a kid, and you know, lived right down the road in Dr. Seifer's clinic for several years during the meet. So yeah, it's I love this place. I've always said it's my favorite track, and honestly, it's the only track that I have a picture of in my office. You know, and I live 15 minutes from Keeneland, but Oaklawn has always been a special place for
nice.
Me.
Nice. So. Well, this worked out. I mean, considering that you had to cancel last year, this worked out beautifully because the hotel was finished and gave Oaklawn really a chance to shine and really show itself off, which it did even before this era. Exactly.
I'm just so happy that the kitchen still has the best sausage gravy on the face of the earth. That was the first thing I did.
It was going to the track
kitchen to make sure it was still the same as I remember as a kid.
Well, they picked up the whole building and they moved it 500 yards. Yeah. Very crazy. It's funny. Awesome.
You can't mess with this track kitchen.
That's right.
You know, they used to be great. I mean, when you wanted to meet somebody, you said, "I'll meet you at the kitchen."
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of tracks left that you really want to go to the kitchen.
I know.
And you know, and actually eat and spend some time, but this one's it. I want to thank you for getting me involved in your situation here.
Thank you, Rick.
You know, speaking this set up there with, you know, Ron and Danny, who I've basically just met for the last few years being here.
Yeah.
Great people in this section. I'm just amazed always as I, you know, I'm sometimes locked over on that side and being able to come to different conferences. It's just amazing the number of stakeholders, the number of people involved in the game to get the show out there.
No,
you see these studies, it affects $50 million worth of this, and people go, how can that be? I said, listen, you have no idea the amount of people and the trickle down and the economic impact it has on the community and the state. It's just amazing.
It really is. And thanks to the American Horse Council, I mean, literally just the racing sector from the last survey that was done, $62 billion economic impact, 240,000 direct jobs. I mean, I think it's over 500,000 when you consider the indirect jobs. But, yeah, you know, the racing industry, I know a lot of people define it as a sport or call it a sport. But my good friend Richard Yates from British Columbia, God rest his soul, he always drilled into my head early on. He was the executive director for British Columbia, HBPA. He said, Eric, this is an industry, and you have to remember it's an industry. Treat it like an industry. It's a sport. It's fun, but the jobs and the people, we rely on it, and so it's an industry.
Tried to make that point yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, that it's a livelihood. It's also a lifestyle that people know. There's groups of there's huge swaths of equine sport community, and it's not limited to thoroughbred racing, of course.
Right.
That it is the only life that the people in it know.
No.
And the lack of respect for that is stunning from critics and from those that, you know, would seek to the ruination, the elimination of equine sport. And I, you know, we got to start. Instead of talking in those terms about racing, we should really say equine sports, because if you you think that they're going to stop at thoroughbred, harness, and quarter horse racing, they're not.
There's plenty of attacks on the rodeo right now. I mean, I've got friends just working with the American Horse Council. I've got plenty of friends, you know, from the quarter horse side, but they, you know, they're the cutting horse folks. They're the reining horse folks. They're, you know, that rodeo Western lifestyle honestly gets quite a bit of attack that most of us in this industry don't see. We're worried about our own self, but that's a real reality when you think about, you know, what those animal rights extremist groups are trying to do. That, you know, they, literally, most of them would just open up the stalls and just say, oh, we need the horses to run free. And it's not just our industry. I mean, in particular, the rodeo world is also hit very hard.
Well, Taylor Sheridan is taking care of that with Yellowstone.
Yeah, so yeah, he's got everybody.
He's fixing that single-handedly. Eric Hamelbeck, everybody. Eric the Tiger, and happy Lent. We didn't get a chance to wish you a happy Mardi Gras, but there it is. Eric Hamelbeck, and Eric, do me one favor and chase down Curtis Linnell. There's no way Curtis is going to avoid at least a 10-minute visit at some point this morning. I want to absolutely get him. Tom Law and Frank Angst, you're going to have a There you go.
Both at the same time?
Yeah, at the same time. Absolutely.
Yeah, baby.
Absolutely at the same time. It's either going to be a very spirited conversation. At the very least, Frank and Tom would represent a very good forecourt power in terms of a basketball
Frank, Frank's playing the five. I'll play the four. I mean, I can't shoot, so.
Well, I'm in.
I'm just good for
sometimes
cheap hacking fouls.
Speed is good, too.
All right. Well, put it.
I'm in.
You could put together a very, they used to have that. Did you used to play in that Santa Anita Basketball League?
No, that was before me.
That was before you?
We played at Monmouth. They played all over, but now we know we have a court in town now.
Oh, and Albert Moquette's. Have you seen Moquette's?
Not yet. I've heard about it.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Oh, it's unbelievable. But Moquette is literally, he's like a one-man wrecking crew.
He's an entertainment destination.
Well,
he is an entertainment destination.
He's taken a page from Churchill's acquisition plan, around Taylor Boulevard, mm-hmm, and at some point they'll own everything up to Taylor, and he's doing the same thing back here behind in Trevista. There, what is it?
Trevista.
Mm-hmm. Trevista. He's
amazing.
He's gonna find Oney Madden's tunnels and out of town.
Nice.
Well, welcome, Frank. Yeah. Haven't seen you in ages. You, I see. Nothing exciting there. I see you all
COVID.
The time.
Back well, not, I mean, the yep. COVID protocols.
Well, and
I was fortunate not to get COVID, yeah.
Well, not exactly, knock on wood. But we had one of these conversations. We had a terrific conversation in the lobby of the Crown Plaza at the old Astor Hotel in New Orleans. Going back three years?
Yeah.
3 years.
Had a good dinner on that trip, as I recall.
Well,
you can't mention New Orleans without dinner.
You can't go wrong.
I've never had a bad meal in New Orleans.
No, exactly right.
It's not going to happen.
Well, Frank, of course, representing the Blood Horse, and Tom. Tom's got a new name on his name tag.
Yeah. So, Steve, we were going to talk about this a couple weeks ago when I was on, and we were just going on and on about random stuff like we normally do, and your power went out in
yep.
Florida, so
yep.
we couldn't announce it, but so me along with my partners Sean and Joe Clancy, ST Publishing, we were approached by the National HBPA about taking over the editorial duties for their publication, the Horseman's Journal, so that started January 1st, so I'm technically the editor of the Horseman's Journal now. From Dennis Blake, did a great job, of course, was given a proclamation about his great job that he did on the publication the last several years. So, as I just told Dennis, no pressure there. You know, you're getting proclamations about how great you are, and now we're taking over. So, but, we brought this into the fold. You know, we it's sort of our business model, you know, not officially, but, you know, we do Mid-Atlantic Thoroughbred kind of in the same capacity. We do some work for the New York Thoroughbred Breeders along the same lines, and now the National HBPA publication, which is a quarterly. We're excited about doing it. I've been working on the first issue for the last, you know, since the year started, basically, but in earnest in the last few weeks. And obviously a big part of our first edition for us will be the,
sure.
the convention. So it's been great to be here. I've never been to the National HBPA event or been to Oakland, for that matter. It's the first time here for
How
me.
How about so, that?
Yeah, I know.
Frank, you've been here before.
I've been to Oakland before, and when I found out the conference was here this year, I made a point of trying to get here because it's a great place to come. And
I did see it. Driving in today, I saw it. It's right across the street. It says Casino Pond. Get back in the game. So I'm not sure that's the best advice.
We're back.
But
in the
it tells you a little bit about where the mindset is in Hot Springs.
I think that's been there for a while. I think they just changed the signage, right? But, you know, welcome, Tom. And yeah. I know Pat was here yesterday. It's his first.
Pat Cummings, too. That's right.
His first run.
Yeah,
in
he
town.
And I were chatting about that.
They gave him the walk-in tour the other day.
I was supposed to come the year Rachel Alexander and Zenyatta were going to have the big race, right?
That
was
the Apple Blossom.
Yeah, it was going to be the Apple Blossom back in whatever year it was.
At a certain point in history, and we're going to talk, actually, glad you went in that direction, because we'll talk about a couple of rip from today's headlines in addition to what is being covered here. We'll talk about the finalists for the Hall of Fame momentarily. But there'll be a certain point where people will say that they actually were at the race between Rachel and Zenyatta. It's going to morph, you know, from the wishing that there had been the great matchup to people thinking there was.
Or they might be.
And Rachel won, by the way.
They might be confused that they were at the race where John Sheriff beat Rachel with his other horse.
Yeah,
there you go. There you go.
Sardana. Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's going to be quite a movie, I understand.
Exactly. Actually, that would be. That'd be a fun, that would be a fun like an E.L. Doctorow, like a ragtime style that, you know, kind of a altered history scenario.
They could take it right up to the movie could end, like when the horses are in the post-parade and going to the gate, and then the gate's open, and that's the end of the movie.
The bell rings,
so that's not bad. To figure it out.
And nobody comes out.
How about that? Well, what
I
a perfect.
Gave it away, though.
A little bit. John Sheriff's.
I was going to say, you're going to tie in that.
There's one of your four horsemen that are finalists for the Hall of Fame. There are some returnees, and
so I'm on the I'm on the nominating committee.
Yeah,
and we have a great call to talk about the finalists. You know, a little inside baseball, and a lot of it we're not really supposed to talk about, but.
That's the first rule of the nominating committee.
Yeah.
Don't talk about the nominating committee. Yeah, that's it.
But during the call, we go through a lot of the candidates, and a lot of people sort of say their piece for certain people that are people or horses that are being considered, and everybody has their own mountain that they go climb and stand up and talk, and John Sheriff's is one for me. I really like him. I really respect him. I think he's an outstanding horseman, and I say it every year on the call. I say, he needs to be on the ballot, and he needs to be in the Hall of Fame. I mean, if you have a Hall of Fame for horsemen and you don't have a guy like John Sheriff's in there, it's not a real Hall of Fame. So, you know, he doesn't have the X number of grade ones or graded stakes or, you know, millions and millions of dollars in earnings, although he does rank very high in a lot of those categories, you know, to some of his contemporaries. But, you know, I mean, you talk about a guy that's an absolute genius horseman, I think. And needs to be in the Hall of Fame. So if there are any voters listening, you know, try to make that happen. You know, I go to bat for Barkley Tag as well. I go to bat for Kona Gold. I went to bat for Awesome again this year. So some of them made it, some of them didn't.
So you mentioned you're on the nominating committee. Who votes? Who are the voters?
So there's the process, basically there's a nominating committee of 15 that kind of comes up with determining the ballot. And then there's a group of voters. I'm not exactly sure the number of voters, but it's probably around 100 to 150, maybe. Racing people, turf riders, probably Frank votes. I vote. Steve, do you vote?
I don't know.
Yeah, so people like us that are in the media. And I think there's other, industry professionals, owners, maybe.
Similar to Eclipse that way? Because I tell you, I don't know anybody in racing that votes.
I was going to say, too, even before the nominating committee, the Hall of Fame sends out a, it's not a ballot, that's not the right word, but they just look for input.
A general call for nominations.
And they do, it's very organized. They put who has already been nominated but maybe didn't get the honor. And they also list all the new qualifiers for that year, you know, is it 25 years?
25 years in the business.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So they list the new qualifiers, and then you can email back, hey, these are people that I feel like the nominating committee should consider, and then that can.
And they open that up to fans and anybody. And, you know, they come up with a pretty long, comprehensive list that the nominating committee goes and reviews.
Well, last night, when I saw the headline, I wrote them all down. And I have to say, besides Tepin, who I didn't see, I mean, I'm very familiar. It's like a, wow, I know all these people and these horses very, you know, well.
Sure, you do.
And it's kind of like, it's almost like, wow, these are people I know. They're going to, you know, nominate to the Hall. When I mentioned the trainers here, Christophe Clement, Graham Motion, Doug O'Neill, John Sheriffs. Well, I mean, Christophe Clement and Graham Motion came up around the same time. I was at Monmouth Park at the time. I was the stakes guy. And in the early 90s, you know, calling everybody under the sun, of course, looking around, a couple of these new names popped up, Clement and Graham. And so we kind of connected and, you know, who do we got this week? And if you look back, and I think in the early 90s, you'll see a lot of Clement and, and Motion winning stakes and doing well at Monmouth Park. So we kind of got to know each other then. And of all the barns that there are in the world, the Clement barn was, I knew everybody from Bertrand now to Christophe, who works for Christophe. And you know, I would walk through the Clement barn, hey, Rick, how are you? So, you know, followed him. And same with Graham. And it was kind of take it for granted. We'll call each other once in a while, hey, what's going on, blah, blah, boom. And then, of course, Doug O'Neill, California, just a super positive guy. You know, he's won two derbies, multiple breeds. He's the same guy that would walk through the door now that he was 20 years ago. And John, you mentioned John, just a unique individual. Doesn't have the gaudy numbers, the stats. But to sit and, if you get lucky enough to sit and hear some stories about, you know, not just the stories, but his involvement in the horse and how he takes care of stuff and, you know, the time he takes. And you know, you see a horse like Zenyatta. Would Zenyatta been Zenyatta with somebody else?
Right.
I don't know. And but, you know, he's won a Derby. Yeah. He's won Breeders' Cups. He's, you know, kind of checked a lot of the boxes, but not with a lot of flash and flair. But I kind of agree with you. I you know, like I said, being, you know, more than just a name on a paper for a lot of these guys, I kind of group them all together, and I'm like, you know what? If the one gets in, you know, I could see them all getting in. They're kind of very similar in their accomplishments. Not, you know, way up here as all-timers, but gosh, Clement won the Derby. I'm very happy to be in a winner's circle when he won his Breeders' Cup with Pizza Bianca at Del Mar. And, you know, Graham's won the Derby and Breeders' Cups. And Doug O'Neill's won two Derbies. And you start thinking, John, should he win a Derby too? You know, type of thing. So, you know, they've done enough. They've been around. And, you know, if I was just going like this, it'd be all fine. And Corey Nakatani, I think, has been one of the shames of the Hall of Fame of that he's not in. You sit there and look at everyone around him in the standings when he rode, from Gary Stevens to Keith DeSormo to you know, Chris McCarron, Alex Solis, Gary Stevens.
And he was the leading rider.
Exactly. Yeah. He's right in the middle and up and down with all of them. So I maybe the fact that he's the only one this year will help. I don't know.
Yeah, he's been on the ballot a few times.
Yeah, so I know he has. Yeah, we'll see. I know he has. So, I mean, my gosh, what a tremendous athlete. Then I look at the horses. I'm going, I named two races after two of these. Behold, we named to change the name to the Beholder, and we named a race the Kona Gold. So I said, well, that should help, too. Yeah. That should get him in. But Beholder, what can you say about her?
Kona. Yeah, and Beholder.
You know, so.
I would think Beholder is the most, well, you never want to say for sure, but it just seems like a shoe-in with what she accomplished.
Absolutely. But a good group. You know, Rags Riches was on before. I mean, Todd had some horses back with us at that time. And there's not a lot of, you know, we watch a lot of races and you see a lot of things. When she broke her maiden at Santa Anita, I think it was for going 7/8, I just remember going, wow. And then she came back. I think she won the Santa Anita Oaks and then, of course, went on to win the Belmont. So just a lot of these names, you know, bring goosebumps to you. Blind Luck and the Harvey DeGrasse, but she was Horse of the Year. So, great job on the nominations. Every once in a while you see and you go, how'd that one get on there?
But a lot of it's dictated by the year and who's eligible and who isn't eligible, you know. And some years you end up with the, you know, okay, we got Rachel Alexander in and we got Zenyatta in. And you're like, what horses are coming up next, you know. And you kind of look at the list and you're like, you know. But
so
I think
horses mean to be retired 5 years? Is
correct.
That,
is that
what it is?
Five on the horses.
There's been, over the last 15 years plus, there's been a lot of, I don't know if you want to call them missteps, but there's been some, you know, strange voting rules that created a backlog for a certain period. You've had a blockage and a ostensibly a individual that was keeping sprinters off the ballot for years. I mean, just bizarrely. So it created this huge backlog of sprinters that needed to be addressed. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Kona Gold continues to not go in is bizarre. And it just is inexplicable. I mean, obviously, the opportunity to put Kona Gold in came when Alex Solis was going in. It would have just been a natural to have them go in together. Kona Gold, I don't know what is going to put him over the top, but it's ridiculous. I mean, obviously, Beholder and Teppan feel like first ballot, you know, this is their first pass. I have voted for Blind Luck the last couple of years, and I you know, there's room for a type like her that has a record that was Hall of Fame worthy. Hof de Grasse and Rags to Riches to me are absolute, not even a momentary thought of no. Rags to Riches did something, had a unique accomplishment. Okay, that's nice. She won the Belmont. It's a filly in the Belmont. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's not a Hall of Fame career. Mm-hmm. There's a problem, though. We've put in Calvin Burrell for 3 Derby wins, but the sum of his career is not Hall of Fame worthy. But he had a unique accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So we've got there's so many cross purposes involved in this that it makes it very, very difficult. Hof de Grasse was Horse of the Year in a mind-blowingly bad season. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's a nice horse. Not a question that she's not for me. But that's my thoughts on the horses. Corey, certainly based on who's gone in of jockeys, it's embarrassing that he hasn't gotten over as well. And when it comes to the trainers, it's very interesting. I mean, John Sheriffs have the same kind of resume that David Whiteley has
also not in.
Also
right?
not in. That the public that the voters have not recognized, because the voters don't seem to understand what kind of a horseman David Whiteley was. There's some inequities involved in this process.
We were fortunate that John was in Saratoga a couple summers. And I had gotten to know him when I worked at Thurber Times and written stories about him, but didn't really get the chance to observe how he goes about and does his work. You know, and I think that's just a huge advantage to be able to do that. And I feel very fortunate to have spent multiple days with him, watch him train his horses, watch him at the barn, and just watch his normal procedure. It's amazing. And then you look at some other guys, and I'm no way would I name names, but you see these other guys that win races, win big races, and they don't even hardly watch their horses train. And I mean, that's mind-blowing to me.
And I haven't fully decided. I mean, I really need to. I always take a lot of time on my votes on this. But one thing about John, and not to compare him to any other specific trainer, but you have to give him a lot of credit for how Zenyatta was handled. I mean, she was in the argument for the best horse of the year for 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
And she won every race until the last one. And I don't care who you're taking on. But most of those were grade one races, and she can't control who shows up. But part of that was self-defining. If you're beating every horse on the West Coast, they're not going to be grade one winners because they're not
right.
beating her.
That's right.
That has to be a big part of when you consider John. I mean, that puts him in a really unique, well, not unique. There's other trainers who've had horses have multiple good years and great years in a row, but that's a big feather in his cap for sure.
You know, you don't get a horse like Zenyatta that reaches the people. You can't make it up. You say, right. Hey, this one, we'd like this one to be a fan favorite. What she did in with Mike Smith and with John, that just brought it out. But the thing about Zenyatta, rather than a horse that goes to the front and keeps on going, it's like, it's nice. It's not really entertaining. She was so, like, pleasing to watch because she passed horses, and she had to pass horses.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to tell you, there was a time in every race she won that she wasn't going to win.
Yeah. You thought, oh my gosh, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. And let me tell you, there was a couple of spots where I had to put some weight on her. And, you know, John and I had a very serious discussion on one of them. And I'll never forget sitting in the grandstand and one day, and somebody came by and said, "Hey, John wanted to tell you, John's waiting for you in his office, wants to talk to you." And I'm like, "Okay, well, I'll be there in a little bit." And another person came by and said, "Hey, John's in your office." You know, kind of, I'm thinking to myself, they must want some seats or something. Mm-hmm. And I went in, and he says, "Let's talk about these weights." And I kind of caught a little off, like, oh, geez. You know, I think she was coming off a layoff, and I think it was her first race back. And I think we put 126 on her, and he was worried about, you know, going down the road, what she was maybe going to get. And let me tell you, when I watched that race, like, and it was one of those moments, like, oh my God, she's going to get beat.
Yeah.
And, you know, I never rooted for a horse so much in my life. And she, you know, she ended up winning and, of course, going on. But that was what's so thrilling about her. And just like you said, the management, would she have had that career, that would she have been managed that well by someone else? I don't know. And can one horse make, and not saying, gee, he's had Manistique, he's had
Manistique
Giacomo.
Is where you got to go. Forget Zenyatta for a minute.
Go
back to the beginning of his career. Manistique was Zenyatta before Zenyatta.
And did you ever see Manistique?
Unbelievable. Huge.
Like,
unbelievable.
What she was able to do with
unbelievable.
That frame
yeah.
was incredible.
So, yeah.
Again,
I got caught up in the Zenyatta thing. You know?
And the best horse he ever trained was Hollywood Story. It's not even a debate. A horse that ran in a maiden race. And then the rest of her career ran in nothing but stakes. Mm-hmm. Go find that somewhere. Yeah. A horse that never ran in an allowance. Broke her maiden in a grade one in the Starlet.
Yeah.
Only could, and curiously, Hollywood Story for the Krikorians only ever won at Hollywood.
Yeah.
The bizarre, the vanity, maybe the Wilshire. She might have won the Wilshire. And the Vanity, the Starlet, she won four stakes. The greatest.
Yeah.
That and it was because of Hollywood Story that I had an interest in Giacomo. Because the year before, because I had gotten to kind of know Sheriffs through Hollywood Story and the way he handled her. Curtis Linnell, we're going to slip Curtis in here. Mm-hmm. Curtis, take that chair. No, stay. He's gonna sit between the two of you. No, you're going to pass the mic.
Here.
Grab that chair. Go Absolutely. Between. You're going to go between the two. No, it's all right. I need you for this as well. There we go.
Vaccinated. I live in New York.
Yeah, you know everybody. You've been interviewed, Curtis, by the two of them, I imagine.
Curtis knows my colleague, Joe Clancy, quite well. I think they're friends, and they...
We've never
time
met.
Time there in Elkton, Maryland.
Curtis Linnell from TRPB. He's the most important man in racing.
I try to stay away from the TRPB.
Very quiet, so.
Well, not now you're not.
No, I'm just kidding.
I've come to you over the years with so many things, and we only a few times have we been able to actually have the conversation. First of all, tell everybody, you're the executive vice president of the TRPB, the Thoroughbred Racing Protective Bureau. It's kind of a different TRPB than it used to be, but Curtis, give everybody, stakeholders, horse players and fans, what your day-to-day responsibilities are at TRPB.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. We have two primary focuses of attention. We do a lot of things. But two primary ones. The first one is our wagering security and integrity platform that we spend a lot of time with, databasing wagering, odds information, prices, results, charts information, the gamut of everything to do with wagering. We monitor that the results of that platform, run reports through it, and then respond back to our clients. We are a private investigative firm, so we have 40 track clients. We also have 9 regulatory clients. So we respond back with the information and results from that platform. Besides the wagering and monitoring, we also run an integrity hotline. Then we respond to complaints about wagering or lack of integrity in horse racing, or allegations of such. We also, and in a big project, and the reason I'm at the HBPA today, is talking about horse identification. We have spent 75 years identifying horses through the use of lip tattoos. Our board made a very big decision after years of debate to move to visual identification through the digital tattoo, putting the information of the horse physically, documenting that horse right on the horse's certificate in the Jockey Club registry. So that's the project I'm here at the HPPA talking about today, and entertaining any questions.
Well, there's a few, there's a, any number of things. Back up and let's focus on the tote protocol and tote monitoring. The question I think that everybody would have immediately, Curtis, is given the, and that, the reason I wanted Frank in here, because Frank has monitored computer-assisted wagering very carefully, has written about it, as he and Hegarty have written about it more than anybody. Talk about it from your perspective and the challenges it has presented, the impression of the betting public that you know, the late odds fluctuations translate to people past posting. Explain what you've, you know, what you've been monitoring, what you see, and how you would like the betting public to view this topic.
Well, I mean, I'm not going to voice opinions. What we do is straight empirical information. So one of the things we do on the platform is to database all bet by bet detail. We timestamp that. We secure that information in a third-party source away from Tote. So we know exactly when bets come in to the millisecond. So we have that information. So if there is ever allegations of past posting, we can prove or disprove that that in fact existed. So that's part of our security platform in which we've been operating and operating successfully for the last number of years. There's a tremendous amount of information in the wagering transaction platform. So much so that we've had to move to, it's not a plug for AWS, but we moved, migrated that whole platform to Amazon Web Services. And it's been tremendous in terms of our ability to query and respond for bets. So we have that information in terms of past posting. On the computer-assisted wagering, always a hot topic. Obviously, there's a lot of professional players who participate in the parimutuel pools, and they participate at varying degrees of technological prowess. That's been occurring for 25 years.
Yeah.
And it's occurring to a greater or lesser extent. Of course, we also have an increasing, ever-increasing percentage of betting, just in general, through advanced deposit wagering systems. So what that means is, in total, money just comes in later, closer to the start of the race. Parimutuel is a price that's struck when the race starts. And the closer that anyone can bet to that, the better information they have. So it's an information race. We've taken a number of steps to speed up such things like odds. We now see the major tote companies. When we started this 20 years ago, there were 60-second odd cycles on the win pool. Now we're at 10-second odd cycles. We can finalize those odds. We've just started to move that into 5 seconds after the break. So those odds are totaled, they're summated within 5 seconds, and that information is available to graphics providers and odds providers. So there's been some tremendous increases. It's always a race as the technology improves on the betting side and the efficiency. It's always a race to total that up from a tote side. There's 50 odd tote systems that interface on every one of our pools. A lot of argument that international providers can do that better, but they have much fewer tote systems interfacing. So it's a complex environment, and we've been able to address some of those major questions around that complex environment and in terms of helping with at least the transparency of what's occurring in the tote system.
Curtis, are the computer players, the computer-assisted wagering, are they specially identified? Are you able to, like, tell, like, when they're getting into pools and potentially affecting odds?
Yeah, all professional teams have identification. So that's transparent.
What does it mean, we hear that these computer vendors have direct access to the tote? What is that? In layman's terms, what does that mean as opposed to me when I go to the machine and I say, tell the guy, give me 10 to 1 on the floor? Mm-hmm. What does that direct line to the tote exactly mean?
Well, if you envision, and if you have an ADW platform, if you envision your PC as taking the place of a terminal, that's exactly the same interface that any professional firms have. Obviously, they do it with a lot more skill. They're professional. And they do it with a lot more speed and efficiency. But that's exactly the same connection. So they have exactly the same connection to tote as any other account wagering provider does.
Well, I knew that, but I don't. The way it's expressed out there in Betland is, oh my gosh, these guys have a way around the system, and they're doing, you know, nefarious things. And that's why I wanted to make clear. I have a direct way to the tote here. It's called a laptop, mm-hmm. and that's what they're doing the same thing. So I just wanted to make that clear that we're on the same table there. They're just betting a lot more money than I am.
There's some interesting analogies and also differences to high-frequency traders in the stock market. And high-frequency traders have went a lot closer to major stock exchanges by having data centers co-located in with stock exchanges and such. We don't see that in professional wagering. We see professional wagering connecting to a remote tote. They connect, again, much more efficiently, and because they're professionals, but their wagers are transparent.
Speaking of that, Curtis, currently, what percentage on a daily basis do we estimate the teams make up right. of the handle in North America?
Yeah, that's always a question I refuse to answer because we don't have the answer. Certainly, it's a large and significant percentage and not a majority.
It's in the 30% range.
So you can put a number to that because it varies widely depending on the pool, on the structure, on the time, the opportunities they see. There's wild variances between betting from race to race and pool to pool, and we see some of those. If you see any large bettors ending up on the same position, on the same horse, close to post, you see odds move. You see that position go down in odds. You see the other horses go up in odds. It is pari-mutuel, but that's any sort of large professional players, computer-assisted and non-computer-assisted, when they land on the same position.
So you said that you've got that time went from 30 seconds. You're down to 5-second intervals now.
So 5 seconds after the bell. The race closes.
After the
right,
bell.
That everything's finalized.
So some of the...
And 10
some of the,
seconds leading into that.
So after the bell closes, 5 seconds later, you have the true odds, and you transmit them to the...
We don't transmit them. The host tote.
The host tote transmits them to the... So some of the delay that we see, that we've all seen at the half-mile pole, the horse goes from, you know, 9 to 2 to...
Propagation delays.
It's just getting the information, getting it to the video board, and then getting it up on the screen.
Well, and it's not just the video board. There's many other forms of dissemination of odds information through ADW platforms, through even some legacy systems. You'll see some very slow odds repeater displays on OTBs as we see a variety of different technology platforms. So there's a lot of difference. When it comes to graphic providers grab those odds at periodic times, and it's really critical that graphics providers refresh their systems very, very quickly. And this is going back years, and I don't want to mention vendors' names, but we had found one graphics provider that when they were running odds on the horses during the race, that they wouldn't update any of their odds until there was a change in position
exactly.
on the running order.
Exactly.
And that created tremendous latency of odds changes. Sure. So with a 5-second complete summary, and again, that's 10 seconds going into
right.
a maximum of 9.99 seconds going into a race, and then 5 seconds coming out of a race, you have extreme efficiencies in terms of the calculation of those odds, and that happens well before the quarter pole. We see it more often with trackers and displays that show right away when horses break. In terms of older graphics providers, we never saw a running order until the quarter pole, until they broke the beam. But now we see that right out of the gate, and you can see that change. Sometimes you can catch that five-second change. We also use fractional odds, and we use fractional odds that are truncated and have very big increments in them. We do all our analysis in digital odds, so we do that down to 5 cents on the dollar. And sometimes there's very little changes, but if those odds change around to 3-2 or 7-5, you'll see those fractional odds change, even though it may be very, very small.
Curtis, what entity determines who owns the odd time? And does the TRPD ever check and make sure that the off time that was recorded to you guys matches like the exact moment that the gate opened?
We do pool close studies all the time on a spot basis. So we look at, first of all, we look at race replays and make sure that the ident on the screen matches the close time. And we'll do that for a number of races for all our track clients and also our regulatory clients. So we'll do spot checking on that. We will find, at times, where graphics providers, there is a time graphics protocol for time of day that should go to hours, minutes, and seconds at the break of the race and be on screen. That's a TRA video protocol. We'll measure that protocol against the close bet time and spot check that, and we want to see that within 1 second.
That's great to hear.
And so there are times the graphics providers don't update their GPS system. The protocol itself requires graphic providers to update every 30 seconds. I know, a number of years ago we found one major graphics provider on the West Coast, I won't mention who that is, had missed a day of updates, and a great group of people. When we gave them the protocol for every 30 minutes for an update of their time ident on screen, they moved to update that. The leader of that group moved to update it every 10 seconds. They just said, forget it. We're going to just update this for GPS. Every 10 seconds.
This is, I mean, for me, this is great because I've had a lot of questions that I wanted to ask. I'm going to ask one more question.
Sure.
You mentioned monitoring. So explain how you provide, quote, security for a pick four bet. Explain the process that you check. Do you check once at the beginning and once at the end? Do you check each race that the money stays the same? Or?
Yeah, and Rick, that's a great question. We don't do live race monitoring.
Okay.
We do in certain occasions. Breeders' Cup and some other big days, we'll do some live race monitoring. But typically we don't. It's all past tense because we're databasing all that information. All our databasing of multi-leg pick pools happens after the first leg. So, for example, an association, a client, can actually have all the bet details in an independent third-party database that they can query after the first leg of a multi-leg pick pool. So they have that, they have a timestamp, they have the wager detail, they have where it came from. And some associations are extremely diligent in terms of doing that each and every day.
So a pick four, mm-hmm. somebody put a pick four, there's a pool, bet stops.
Yep.
Is there a check that's done, not by you, but by like the tow companies that did it, the second leg that there's another $10 slipped in there, somebody here. And then the third leg, and then the fourth leg. Is there a check to see that, everything stayed the same on all these multiple horizontal bets?
Yeah, and that was a fairly early protocol put in after the picks, the Breeders' Cup pick scandal.
The Arlington deal.
It's called the Progressive Pool Matrix, which, and I may have just the terminology wrong, but what it does is keep the number of dollars tracked. Just by dollars.
Correct.
And by a total pool from leg to leg. and number of winners, and it's exactly the same information that you'll see after five legs. Well, they'll put the number of generate the probables for
right.
the last leg.
Yeah.
So that's exactly the same thing, and that, of course, only changes if there's a late scratch in the last leg. And then
right. But the money doesn't change.
The money doesn't change.
The same number that went in after the first, right. hopefully, is there to the fifth leg,
yeah.
and that's
well,
checked.
And leg to leg.
Leg to leg, that's checked.
That's automatic.
That's automatic. Yeah. And that's done by the tow companies?
That's done by the tow companies. Our information is far more granular.
Right.
Because we'll database each and every bet.
Okay.
So each and every bet that goes into that pool and a timestamp, and we'll have that when the pool closes. And we'll have that available to the client for query.
Specifically on pool closings, Curtis, is it still a human element, the stop betting button?
Yes. Yeah. By and large, it's a steward or official's function of stop betting.
And there's a tow company representative also, I believe.
There is some backup.
So is a yeah. backup, either on-site or
right.
mobile that can...
Yeah, at a hub. Typically, tow companies will monitor these things at the hub. Again, it's not perfect because you do have human element in, so there can be delays in that, and that's one of the things we do when we check the time, date, IDEN to the stop betting. Again, we want to see that within 1 second. If there is any tardiness on the close of betting and that exceeds 1 second, we'll identify that to the client or the regulator as applicable.
On this topic, one of the things that people always float whenever there's an incident or the perception of an incident is, why don't we shut off the betting a minute to post when the horses are assembling behind the gate? Is that a practical solution to some of these issues?
Lo and behold, there's been a lot of various debates about when betting should close, where the market is moving, where the demand of the market is ever increasingly close to the start of betting because the technological ability is there. Lots of things happen before the gates break, before the gates open. And so if you look at where the customer demand is, the customer demand is as close to the start of the race as possible. So if the industry, we don't have an opinion on this. Associations, regulators can close the betting whenever they want. Having said that, though, where customer demand is putting that as close to the start of the race as possible. And in fact, as we look at the popularity internationally of betting exchanges, with betting available during the in-running
yeah.
of the event, if we look at sports betting, the market has moved to betting going in-game. We see the majority of betting going on horse racing, much in an Asian handicap environment in Asia. So that's where the market is going, ever increasing. It's up to the technology providers in order to make that efficient, effective, and transparent instantly when that occurs.
Wasn't it tried at one time, I believe, after the Breeders' Cup sort of pick six scandal? They tried to... I don't know if I'm drawing the two things together, but I felt like in New York they were shutting the pools down a minute to post or something. It seems like my memory. And when Barry Schwartz was in charge of NIRA, I felt like they were. Steve, maybe do you remember when they did that?
There was some experimentation
yes.
on that.
And I don't
yeah,
think
yeah.
it worked.
Well,
and they kind of they saw their numbers drop. So like you said,
there was a variety of things off track. Had to close a minute to post. On track stayed right to post time. There was a lot of. A lot of various changes to the extreme that we see in Southern Florida, in which we close betting 7 minutes past scheduled post time because the horses were delayed all the time for a long period of time, which everyone found unworkable in terms of coordination of race time. So, I mean, the gamut has been tried. What is effective is when betting closes, to make sure it closes, to make sure that information is documented and databased and is available to query so the appropriate authorities can get that information when they need to verify that things are happening the way they should be. I keep going back to this fractional odds system. It's a horrible, inefficient way to show odds. Let me
throw us one quick question here, and you can make it a sound no. Once you hit the button and you close the wagering, it cannot be reopened again, or can it?
Wagering, there is a possible way to reopen that, which takes a whole change in protocol in terms of re-livening a pool. Very, very difficult to do. Very time-consuming. Very, very
problematic. Flesh that out for a second, because obviously this goes back to the Breeders' Cup juvenile turf situation where modern games, you know, being taken out of the pool, then put back in. I mean, what was your observation there? What learning came out of this? And again, what is the betting public? How should they view what transpired and its aftermath?
Well, whenever, in general, and not to talk about the specific instance of the Breeders' Cup, because I feel for them, whenever there's, and I feel for the wagering public too, whenever there's a mistake, and especially if there's a mistake that involves a scratch, that's horrible. You know, we need procedures and processes in place so there isn't an incorrect scratch. And there's a 5-second dolphin rule when somebody says, scratch this horse. And it's are you sure? Do we have second party confirmation? Because a scratch is in lots of ways irreversible from a rules perspective and from a tote perspective. So you can re-liven a horse. You know, bets are, the bet file is independent, but you have a lot of difficulty in terms of doing that, because now you've been offering betting with a horse scratched that's actually in the race. You know, that's a live betting pool. So the solution is to put the process and procedures in place to avoid that from occurring.
One of the reasons I asked that question is from Steve's prior question. So let's say we decided to say, you know what, we're going to close the tote at post time. Post time's 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock hits, shut the bet, shut the wagering. Hopefully the horses get in there and they're gone at a reasonable time. But we decide to do that, and horse loses a shoe, and we have a delay, and it's going to be a 10-minute delay. Everybody knows it's 10-minute delay. The windows are shut. Darn, we got 10 minutes to do. And that's why I asked, could you say, you know what, we, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to reopen the wagering for this race for another 6 minutes. And that's why I asked if that was possible. If we ended up going to a certain time where we're shutting those windows out and we end the circling and we go at a certain time, would there be an opportunity? Because that's one of the negatives, and that's what we're worried. There's a worry that, you know, we shut the time out and then, oh, geez, there's a delay now and we've lost 6-7 minutes of betting. Could we say, you know what, we're going to reopen the pools now while the horse gets a reshot and comes back in, and there's no loss or a less chance of loss.
Had you just left them open, you would have had that 6 minutes of bet.
Correct. But I said the discussion was possibly shutting them down at a certain point, a predetermined time. And I'm trying to find reasons like why we don't do that, because, you know, be a very much of a confusion to, are we opening the windows? What? Oh, it's only going to be 3 minutes, so we won't. So, but that's what I'm saying. The customer wants right down to the end. Mm-hmm. They don't want
to
shut down.
Customer wants right down to the end, as we saw some tracks, and some tracks really had to make a decision to load at post time, because tracks wanted to delay that because always pushing the envelope. That's where the market is. So what we need to do is work on the marketplace, on the technology, to make sure that's efficient and effective and updates and everyone's kept transparent and current, rather than some fairly archaic structure that's not going to work anyway. I mean, everything that's been tried has failed, so let's work on what we can improve and do. We've made great progress in wagering integrity and security systems, and we expect that progress to continue. Now we're on the cloud, we can take very large data sets and query those within seconds. The difference in performance is amazing. Just one benchmark, and I'm going to have to run pretty quickly, but when we made the decision with our technology partners, which is the Jockey Club Technology Services and Encompass, we benchmarked how the cloud would improve performance. So we took all of 2019 Belmont Stakes Day, and we put that into a test database. And we were currently using SQL. And the ability to database all transactions at a transaction level on the Belmont Stakes, to get those into a database and then to query those in terms of finishers, for us, with that much information, took 29 minutes. So 29 minutes after the race was off, we were able to query things on the Belmont Stakes. We took all of that to AWS, and we were able to do that in 28 seconds. So the difference in quickness and performance is tremendous. So we're very, very pleased with the performance metrics we see on the ability to query bets when a race closes. 28 seconds, as long as Toke can get us those, 28 seconds actually puts the query of bets before the finish of the races in lots
wow.
of cases.
And obviously, the easy follow-up question to that is, how widespread a basis of daily running of races? On Monday there were three racetracks running. Tomorrow, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there'll be 19 running. So extrapolate the number of races. How much probing of Mahoning Valley on a Tuesday in the third is being done to look for anomalies and inequities in wagering that might indicate some sort of a
malfeasance?
Yeah,
right.
I was going to say malfeasance, but I didn't know if it was appropriate.
I wanted to scoop you on
good
that.
Work.
There you go.
So
good
work.
We run every TRA track and every track in a client regulatory jurisdiction through a number of different algorithms. So all of it is the answer. It's not done while it's happening, but we run that in the week that race has occurred. We run all the wagering through three different programs looking for alerts and flags and triage those. That's not just the only way we look at wagering events, but it's our primary fashion because there's so much data. So we have to. We have a wagering integrity unit, and they'll take the results of that of those alerts, and they'll triage those, and they'll look for ones that need to be investigated.
Further investigated.
Dealt further to deal with stewards and client racetracks. And there is, so all of it, again, not all tracks are TRA members, not all jurisdictions, not all regulators are clients.
Why wouldn't a track be involved in this?
Well, we are currently, we were at the limit of our technological ability on the platform, one of the reasons we went to AWS. So we are now talking to independent tracks outside the TRA about signing integrity services agreements. We have 9 integrity services agreements with regulators. I expect us to have integrity services agreements with all regulators at some point. So currently that's 9 jurisdictions. And so we're, now that we have the ability of scale, I believe that we can go and have every jurisdiction in Canada and the U.S. and every track in Canada and the U.S. at least to an A or B level as part of the program.
Curtis, is any of this part of HISA in terms of what was presented to the FTC?
Right. As most people know, Hank Zeitlin, who's
yes.
is president of the TRPB and also executive vice president of the TRA, took a leave of absence as the interim executive director of HISA. And so he and I have had less discussions than anybody else in the industry because he is in a leave position. He's returning to the TRA soon in his role. Currently, HISA does not have any overlap with wagering, and that has not been part or a mandate of the authority and has not been discussed in terms of the authority other than some of the existing racetrack safety and integrity protocols in place.
Wow, I wish you could stay another hour.
He's the most valuable guest in racing media, Curtis Linnell. I do have. You're not the most valuable guest.
What?
You're an addendum.
I like Tom.
You know what?
I'll take Tom and Rick over me.
It's all good news. It's all good news, and that you know people need to feel secure in their when they go to the window, and you're telling them that yes. We're keeping an eye. We got the eye in the sky. It's wonderful.
It's not perfect. Again, we can always use more resources. We can use wider adoption in terms of when I mentioned regulators and racetracks, because there are racetracks and regulators outside of our scope. But I believe we're on the right path. And so we can. It's not perfection, but we can work at it.
What can you mention jurisdictions that are not that are?
Because we're talking to so many regulators.
You'd rather
right now,
okay,
I'd rather
gotcha,
not.
Gotcha.
And we've done so much to migrate this platform for the scalability that we're in a position to do that now. So we're having multiple discussions discussions on multiple threads with regulators.
Curtis, I do want to come back. I do want to come back to you. In coming weeks, because I want to have the follow-up with the conversation that I had off-air with Paul Berube, which was just unbelievable. And I want to talk about boots on the ground, the earlier incantation of TRPB and whether there's potential for that to be rebooted, essentially, to work with the kind of people that were part of the original TRPB and the work that has to be done on the racetrack, on the backstretch, even in the grandstand, et cetera. This has been one area that has come up in, let's say, the last, really as part of the postscript to this Five Stones investigation and why the industry got away from having its own full-time investigatory agency with teeth.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right. That's what I wanted. That's what we wanted to hear. Curtis Linnell, everybody from TRPB, and is the TOTE protocol working group still a moniker?
It is
still, right?
It's the International TOTE protocol group, and it meets every year during the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Symposium. Yeah. Did again this year.
After a hiatus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We have every major international TOTE group involved, and it's been tremendous.
It's important.
It is.
And it's underreported. So get on that, Law.
I'm on it. new gig.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Curtis. Curtis Linnell, who I, at any opportunity that I can grab and extract that kind of information, just an invaluable resource for the industry and somebody that's worked. How long, Curtis? How many years doing this?
A lot.
We're just gonna use the amorphic a lot. There you go. Thank you. I really appreciate it because it, you got to go.
I got to go too.
Why are you leaving? What?
I got an appointment with Moquette.
Unbelievable. All right. If you have to leave for the airport from here, you got either an hour drive or a 2 hour drive.
If you can get an Uber, I thought about going to dinner last night. I had called up like three Ubers.
And no, nobody would take it.
It started coming, and then they canceled out on me.
To Little Rock?
Just to downtown.
You could have walked.
I ran.
Oh, an appointment. I thought it said airport.
No, appointment.
Okay, he's got an appointment. Unbelievable.
Appointment with an Uber.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Tom.
Thanks, guys.
We'll see you.
Yeah, I'm around.
All right.
I'm here.
See you at the races.
Yeah, I'm here till Saturday. Can't wait.
Look at you.
Can't wait to go to the races.
Well, I'll be at Fort Lauderdale. I'll be at Holiday.
I'll be firing.
Atta boy.
Even if it rains, we're going to run.
I'm in.
Oh, hey now. Oh, Zets. Unbelievable. As Hammer can't resist that. We're coming up to the bottom of the hour. We do have to take the 90-minute break, so that is actually right upon us. But, Rick, you managed to include another rip from today's headlines. We talked about the Hall of Fame finalists, Beholder Blind Luck, Hobb DeGraw,
Kona Gold, Rags to Riches, Tepin on the horse side, Christoph Clement, Graham Motion, Doug O'Neill, John Sheriffs, and Corey Nakatani. Then you just mentioned the fact that tomorrow's card at Santa Anita is going to be postponed and then run Monday. That's that plan.
In its entirety, they're not going to redraw. They're just
it's
just move the whole deal, which is a lot easier if you're going to do that.
Before we take that break, actually, those are the major headlines. Yesterday, I didn't mention there's virtually a Baffert headline daily. Yesterday, I forgot to mention that Baffert has taken up a lawsuit against CDI and Bill Carstangen, and there was also the delay of the suspension hearing, and there was also the Kentucky Circuit Court asked the KHRC to delay the 90-day suspension of Baffert. This is I don't spend a lot of time on it because it just is changing literally on a daily basis. Let's take our break here. Leroy Gessman is close at hand, and the chance to talk to Curtis Linnell, we just had to take it. We'll come back. We're going to get a hold of Bob Hutton in Arizona. We're going to discuss the situation in Arizona with two parties that know it best and might be able to provide some answers. Back to Oaklawn, the beautiful new hotel here, and the HBPA convention, and more after this at the races. Sirius XM.
Shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-9
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
At the races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back at the races, and we're going to be joined by Bob Hutton, and who's on the line with me. Bob, good morning, and let me hook you up here so you can hear from me and from Hammer and from Leroy.